From NPR and The Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The Senate immigration bill makes it out of committee and onto the broader Senate floor.
The bill, I think, has emerged from the committee remarkably unscathed, considering how controversial it has been.
What's in, what's out, and in what shape is this proposed reform? And then, what Chicago loses in closing scores of city schools?
To be hit with this, nobody seems to care that we're going to just destroy all of this.
And we find out how science can break down family history and rebuild Latino identity.
I was taught to praise and love and adore everything that was European about my existence and to disdain and feel embarrassed by anything that was indigenous or African.
Author Raquel Cepeda on her book, How I Became Latina. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Quédense con nosotros. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The U.S. has inched closer to immigration reform now that the Senate Judiciary Committee has approved the bill crafted by the so-called Gang of Eight. That's the bipartisan group of senators who came together to get immigration reform on the agenda. After 2 long weeks of debate over hundreds of proposed amendments from their colleagues on the Hill, the bill now heads to the Senate floor. To talk about which of those amendments made it into the bill and which ones didn't, we're joined by Julia Preston. She's a national immigration correspondent for the New York Times, and by Ted Hessen, who's the immigration editor at Fusion, the joint project from ABC and Univision. They join us from Washington, D.C., where they watched the whole process unfold. And welcome to Latino USA to both of you.
Thank you, Maria.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So the Senate bill cleared another hurdle, but tell us about the highlights of the bumps and bruises that it took throughout the process. Let's start with you, Julia. What stood out during this whole process?
This bill has really emerged from deliberation over 301 amendments, essentially in the same framework and with most of the major provisions still intact. There was considerable back and forth, but the most tenacious opponents to the bill did not, in the end, really make much headway. The hardest compromises came, for example, over visas for high-skilled immigrants in science and technology, and there was a kind of a hard-fought compromise there with Senator Orrin Hatch, who is from Utah, and succeeded in making the visa provisions more generous for the technology companies who were advocating for them. On the whole, the bill, I think, has emerged from the committee remarkably unscathed, considering how controversial it has been.
All right, Ted, was it as easy as Julia says it was from your vantage point?
I do agree with Julia. In essence, I think that the bill was able to preserve the pathway to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, as well as the border security measures that they're able to sell to conservatives to show that they'll be shoring up the border. I think actually there were a couple positives that came out of this for undocumented immigrants. One of the big positives was for Dreamers, who are young undocumented immigrants, and it was enabling them to get access to federal funds for college, excluding Pell Grants. It's a small gesture in a bill that has a lot of large-scale features to it, but it's something that as the bill moves forward through the House that I'm sure people will hope is in there.
So, Julia, tell us what happened in terms of Senator Patrick Leahy and his proposal in terms of immigration and gay rights and gay marriage.
It involved an American citizen who wants to apply for a green card based on a same-sex partner relationship or a marriage with a same-sex partner. And immigration law currently doesn't allow that. The Republicans in the Gang of Eight basically made this a deal breaker. They said, if you put this amendment on the bill, we will abandon it. It will not pass. And there was a very dramatic scene in the Senate Judiciary Committee where the Democrats appealed to Senator Leahy not to introduce his amendment.
Let's talk for a moment about enforcement. because it does remain a priority. There are some amendments that did pass that are interesting. One in particular is Senator Blumenthal's amendment that would block immigration raids in sensitive areas such as schools, hospitals, churches. This is something, again, that for people on the ground is going to mean something. What else stood out for you in terms of the enforcement amendments?
I mean, one of the things that's interesting about that is currently immigration and customs enforcement policy, but there's been considerable resistance to that policy from within the ranks of the ICE agents. And so what this would do would put into law a policy that has been controversial within the agency and kind of reduce that dispute, that internal dispute.
All right. So, Ted, what comes next for this Senate bill? What are the next steps?
At this point, they're looking forward to June. They want to have the bill on the Senate floor in June. And I actually sat in a press conference with one of the members of the Gang of Eight, Colorado Senator Michael Bennett, who was saying that his expectation was to have this bill voted on by the end of June. At the very least, they want to have it finished up before the August recess comes around.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us on Latino USA to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Julia Preston is with the New York Times, and Ted Hessen is the immigration editor at Fusion, a joint project of ABC and Univision. It's almost the end of the school year, which should mean happy days for students. But in Chicago, news now about dozens of schools closing. This month, we've teamed up with students from the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University to look at the Chicago Public School District, which is the third largest in the nation. Despite protests this week from parents and students, school officials announced that 50 city schools won't be reopening next year. More than 1,000 teachers and staff members are expected to lose their jobs. Children will be reassigned, including some 2,400 with special needs. At Lafayette Elementary, on the city's west side, more than a quarter of the students, 148 of them, receive special education. Medill's Brian Lowry looks at what the impact of losing their neighborhood school could mean.
Lisa, take your time. Hold on one second.
6-year-old Lisa Nelson has autism. It impairs her fine motor skills and limits her ability to communicate. But when her teacher, Leslie Williams, talks, Lisa listens.
Go slow. Take your time, Lisa. Good job.
It's an early evening in May, after regular school hours. The special ed teacher is giving Lisa a lesson at Lisa's home.
We're using tracing paper. As you can see, she can actually see her name under there. Yeah.
Lafayette Elementary School dedicates 6 special classrooms for children with autism and similar disorders. Classes are limited to 13 students, and high-needs children like Lisa work with the same teacher for multiple years. But with the school slated to close, Lisa will be sent to another school. Miss Williams will only be eligible to go along if there's an opening available.
To be hit with this, nobody seems to care that we're going to just destroy all of this.
District officials said in a statement that students will continue to receive all of the services outlined in their individual education plans. The district has also promised to train faculty at schools receiving special needs students in disability awareness. But disability advocates say the large numbers of students pose a challenge.
What's your name?
Miles, hi.
On a recent Miles? Sunday afternoon, 4-year-old Miles Puente confidently runs up his porch steps to grab a handful of strawberries from a plate.
Good.
Miles' mom, Tanya Puente, says when Miles started at Lafayette in the fall, he was nonverbal and still in diapers.
When he started there, he couldn't do any of this stuff. And to see people look at him when he's tantruming, look at me and see, well, you know, what kind of mother are you? You're not doing this, that, and the other. But to see him being accepted and not made fun of, it's a wonderful thing.
Puente says she doesn't know if Miles will be as successful at a new school. Specialists say breaking routines can cause children with autism to regress and lose skills they've developed. At Lafayette, Miles works one-on-one with aide Patrick Williams, who the Puentes credit for much of Miles' progress. When the school closes, Williams will lose his job and will only be able to continue working with Miles if he is hired by his new school.
It definitely makes you want to shake your fist at all times, like, you know, I put that work in. Who's to say that putting him in a new environment, different people, new people, who's to say that he won't go back?
The Chicago Teachers Union filed a federal lawsuit against the school district this month. It alleges that the impact of closings on students like Miles violates the Americans with Disabilities Act. So, it'll be up to the courts to decide where Miles Puente and thousands of other children like him go to school next year. For Latino USA, I'm Brian Lowry.
Another school that will be closing in Chicago is the Henson Elementary School. School officials say it costs $9.3 million a year to maintain the building. But as Medill's Jennifer Kirby reports, people in the neighborhood say Henson is more than just a school and a building. It's an integral part of the community.
In a classroom at Matthew A. Henson Elementary School on Chicago's west side, a volunteer unloads bags of yellow onions onto the linoleum floor while a customer picks through green bell peppers. In a corner, someone's making fresh orange juice. Every other Tuesday, the Greater Chicago Food Depository delivers fresh fruits, vegetables, and canned goods to this pop-up food pantry as part of its Healthy Kids Market. Last year, more than 80 Henson families took home shopping bags of food.
We have apples today and bananas. So it's a very healthy meal.
The Greater Chicago Food Depository says they'll try to find another home in the community. But the food pantry is just one of dozens of neighborhood services that operate at the school. Just down the hall from the pantry, there's a health clinic that saw more than 600 patients last year. Tina Smith is the parent of a Henson third grader. Smith's mother and her adult daughter also use the clinic.
People don't have the resources, or they just don't take the time to go to the doctor. Now here, when the kids, time for immunizations, the ladies in the clinic, they'll let you know, they'll call the kids down from class, they give them their immunizations, and they go right back to class.
The clinic gives workshops on parenting, first aid, healthy eating, and resume writing. There's a small computer lab where people can look for housing or fill out applications for food stamps.
A letter to a classmate or to the class.
Okay, how about a letter from Henson?
Another successful program at Henson is the after-school program called America Scores. It offers everything from homework help to arts instruction to athletics. Donnell Osley, or Coach D as he's called, coordinates the program, which is also open to family members of students. He says it's an opportunity to bring parents into the school in a positive way.
This is now a different feedback versus your child's not listening, they're not doing their grades. You know, it was a different light that was shined on their children and on their home. So then after speaking with that parent, being able to say, would you like to join a fitness class, or would you like to be involved in a health program, you know, where you can come up, spend more time with us here.
The State Board of Education says when Henson closes, the America Scores grant money will likely follow students to the new school. As for the health clinic, the future is uncertain, but organizers say they'll try to move to another neighborhood school, if there's space. For Latino USA, I'm Jen Kirby.
Medill's student, Carrie Edson, also contributed to that story. And all of our reports on the Chicago Public Schools were prepared by students at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University in Chicago, under the direction of journalist and professor Cecilia Weissman. Coming up on Latino USA, writer Raquel Cepeda's ancestors spoke to her in her dreams and through her genes.
I wanted to use ancestral DNA testing to discover, to explore, and to see if I can have a confirmation of all the things that I thought I was.
That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan.
Que diga la hora exacta en distintos idiomas.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Is one born a Latina or does one become a Latina? What are the strands that come together to make this identity? And how do the secrets our families keep shape us? These are some of the questions explored in a new memoir by Dominican American author and filmmaker Raquel Cepeda. Her new book, Bird of Paradise, How I Became Latina, is published by Atria Books. And we're very pleased to have Raquel Cepeda with us in the studios at NPR New York. Hola, Raquel.
Hola. I'm so happy to be here with you, Maria.
Do you become a Latina or is one born a Latina? Or did you just say, I've got to research this and figure it out?
I was always interested because of my ethnic ambiguity and my father's own rejection of where he came from. I always wondered what makes a Latino, what is an identity? So when I became an adult, I wanted to use ancestral DNA testing to see if I can have a confirmation of all the things that I thought I was. And being from Santo Domingo, you know, Dominican American, that was the seat of the Americas. That's where the transatlantic slave trade started. That was a site of the first rebellion in the Americas. So many things happened that were interesting in the Dominican Republic that I never even learned about in school. I was taught to praise and love and adore everything that was European about my existence and to disdain and feel embarrassed by anything that was indigenous or African.
You're growing up Dominican American in New York City, but your dad says in order for you to be accepted in white America, he makes you be an expert tennis player. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind just reading this little section here and capturing what it means to have a dad like yours.
Get up, I say, Bobby demanded. I didn't say goodbye to the guys and follow Bobby to the courts in the back. I'm gonna fix you with this when we get home, he said, pointing at his racket. F Bobby, I thought every time he threatened me. The notion of returning the favor one day became my motivation to live, to survive. Every beating, I thought, brought me a step closer to freedom. The tennis players looked away, just like our neighbors did on the mornings when they heard me screaming for Papi to stop pummeling me. Now, the same guys are staring at Ercilia as she walks by, hand in hand with Alice. I imagine they're thinking what I'm thinking. Ercilia's whiteness is a figment of Papi's imagination.
So what did you uncover when you discovered your own DNA?
This whole experiment started with me trying to mortify my dad, proving that he's not quote-unquote Jewish, because to him, Jewish is only Ashkenazi, it's only, you know, white, it's only, he doesn't understand, being immigrant, that Jews are everything. They could be Ethiopian, they could be any, white, black, whatever. So when I did his DNA test, he was like, okay, yeah, whatever. And I found out that actually he came from one of the oldest indigenous lines, pre-Columbian lines, that existed in the Dominican Republic. One of those lines, one of those peoples that academia has committed genocide against. Because, you know, they say that all these Tainos died, but really they live on in fragments, just like every other thing that lives on in the Latino soul.
So the postscript of your book has you doing something very different. It has you going out and talking with young Latinas who are dealing with a lot of emotional turmoil of their own. What's your message to them? What do you see from them? Is there resolution coming?
I always say identity is fluid. You know, we're always changing. We're always shifting. So I tell a lot of Latinos, especially, you are born to rule in the Americas, okay? Being an American is being Latino. And in the postscript, it ends at Life is Precious. It's a suicide prevention program. They're located in the Bronx and in Brooklyn, but I work with the girls in the Bronx. And I'm doing a DNA project with them where they find out where their direct maternal, their biblical Eves, if you will, come from. And so far, all of them have either been West African, Central African, or indigenous. So I said to them, listen, you owe your ancestors. We come from a culture of ancestor reverence and worship. If they found a way to survive in your blood, in your bloodstream, then you owe them. You're built to survive. You're built to move on. You're built to lead.
Raquel Cepeda, thank you so much for all of your work and for opening these doors. We really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Raquel Cepeda is the author of Bird of Paradise, How I Became Latina. It's published by Atria Books, and she joined us at the studios of NPR New York. And now, a Civil War story we're sure you didn't hear about from Ken Burns. An immigrant Cubana who disguises herself as a man to fight in the war.
I must learn to act, to talk, to almost think like a man. I am known as Harry T. Buford, Confederate soldier.
Loretta Velázquez arrives in New Orleans as a young girl. The daughter of a wealthy Cuban family, she loses her children to fever and her husband dies in an accident. Without any family to call her own, she decides to follow in the footsteps of her idol, Joan of Arc. Her story is told in a new documentary called Rebel. It's the passion project of writer-director Maria Aggie Carter.
I'm a history buff. I had watched every hour of Ken Burns' Civil War. There was no mention of this kind of unlikely character, much less the women soldiers. I learned that, in fact, historians have found hundreds and hundreds of women who are now documented to have fought in the American Civil War. And here is this woman, Loretta Velázquez, who'd written a memoir, The Woman in Battle, in 1876, one of only two 19th century memoirs published by a Latina in the U.S., and no one knew about her.
After the war, former Confederate General Jubal Early labeled her story a hoax. As Loretta's book disappeared, so did the history of other women soldiers. We now know that an estimated 500 to 1,000 women fought in the war. Loretta's story, though, gives new meaning to the term double pass. It also raises lots of questions about our notions of race and gender. First, she fought as a white man for the South, even owning a black slave named Bob. But later, she became a double agent, spying for the Union Army. In the film Loretta, Carter found not only a character from history she never expected, but she found a character with a shared history.
Loretta came to the U.S. at 7 years old. I also came to the U.S. at seven from Latin America, as she did. She came to love this country, and she was a Latina, and she was a woman. Two things that, in any century, are difficult categories to fall in. There are stereotypes and expectations of what a woman and what a Latina can do, and she defies all those expectations.
Rebel is premiering nationwide on PBS. Check our website, latinousa.org, for local times. And for this week, that's Latino USA. Please become our amigos. You can friend us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. We love our amigos. And now we're also on Tumblr. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Lita Hartman, Andres Caballero, Daisy Rosario, Diana Montaño, Michael Simon Johnson, and Michael Jones. Latino USA is a production of the Futuro Media Group in Harlem. Our program was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. And the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to a vigorous presence for poetry in American culture. PoetryFoundation.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.